This is Elevations, bringing new perspectives to science, technology, education, and the arts. I'm your host, Amy Reynolds. Our guest today is Michael Chanik Jr., a Kent State alumnus and a Cincinnati-based gay rights activist. He worked to get Procter & Gamble to protect the rights of gay people against discrimination. Welcome, Michael.
Pleasure.
I'd like to hear a little bit about what you were doing at Procter & Gamble in the 80s and what was happening at the time for listeners who may not be as familiar with that.
I started as a technician in a technical area of oral care. I was actually a lab worker. And at the same time as I got involved in the gay community and made a very surprising appearance at a gay pride parade in 1986, those things were not done for P&G employees. And, of course, that outed me, and everybody knew about it, and it was on the local TV station for 3 days in a row. It was such a thing, you know. And, of course, what was I doing but kissing the late Dr. Bob McNeil, retired geography prof from University of Cincinnati? So that really turned some heads. Now, there was a lot of quiet support, but honestly, I was very much warned. You know, you need to be careful here, Michael. You need to be careful. So now, how mysterious that within, 6 months of being in that pride parade, I'm transferred to a brand. It was called Paradex. It was a antimicrobial mouth rinse. The active ingredient is chlorhexidine gluconate. It's still manufactured today, but owned by 3M, someone else now. And it had been discovered that it had some effect on oral thrush or oral candidiasis, a condition that a lot of people with AIDS would have, because at that time there weren't effective remedies. The remedies that did exist for thrush or oral candidiasis were pretty draconian stuff. And this was simply a mouth rinse that had the convenience of a mouth rinse and didn't have all those systemic side effects. And the company, Ann Harbison, the brand assistant, had noticed that there was some unusual ticks in the consumption of the product in major metropolitan areas. Well, they analyzed it and figured it out. And that's how the company began to promote to professionals, because they didn't have a label indication for oral candidiasis. So they went direct to the professionals and made them aware. And then they started doing focus groups with PWAs, persons with AIDS. And from there, P&G began to do this dance with professionals and the gay community. And enter Michael, who raised the question, wait a second, you can do these other things and you can try to leverage the diversity of these other groups, Hispanics, Asians, women, you name it, folks of color, but you can't mention gay and lesbian folks. Paradex was the key to this, but I think that argument ultimately kind of called in task their integrity in the matter. Now, one thing P&G is, they are people of integrity. I know people will find that hard to believe that I would endorse it that way, but here is this very conservative company willing to engage and spend money in this research to understand this problem at a time that most people would never have done that, unless it was some high-level pharmaceutical company that's all they did, which was not Procter at the time. So in that sense, very unusual.
So in terms of why you felt there was a need for change, right, and what sort of spurred you to take some action, maybe talk a little bit about that.
You know, I was a graduate of Kent State. I left here in 71. I saw May 4, 70. The times I was raised in were anybody who grew up in the 60s, and you know who you are. Those things change you. To see a president assassinated, to see someone running for the office assassinated, to see a civil rights person assassinated, those things kind of send shivers up your spine, and you begin to realize, now I hear I'm lecturing, right? You learn that when the state decides to take away your rights, as such was the case on May 4th, 1970, it's all gone in a flick of a light switch. People don't recognize how fragile freedom is, and how important it is to always, forever and a day, advocate for that which is right and that which frees people. I'm also a second-generation Greek-American, and my people, both sides of the family, came over on the boat from Ordu, Turkey, which was then really part of Greece. And there was religious persecution in my upbringing. That area was Christian, but as the Ottoman Empire collapsed, they were Muslim, and those traditional conflicts played out, so a lot of the family came here. So I have this whole background of strife and unsettledness and social action, and no wonder, you know, at some level, no wonder. I was also very lucky to have met people through the local Episcopal Church, Church of Our Savior in Cincinnati. In 1978, I got to Cincinnati. Just by chance, I walked into that church and went to the local gay church, so-called AKA gay church, with quotes, the Metropolitan Community Church, was meeting in the premises of the Church of Our Savior. And Church of Our Savior at those time, as was the gay church, was just full of academics. You know how academics are, troublemakers from UC. There was just a kind of a weight of folks that were interested in seeing change. And Cincinnati was always conservative. Even, I think you noticed in the video, they were referred to, I think it's Mark Twain's quote, if the world comes to an end, that sort of thing. It was very true for the gay community. They were still raiding the local Burnett Woods for, quote, homosexual sweeps, you know, at that time. And the church I was affiliated, the pastor of the church of the New Spirit MCC, was then a Howard Goss. He's still alive. He actually had the nerve to go on the air and take the police to task. You know, when you get that kind of support, that kind of mentoring, some of it rubs off and some of it plays to who you are, or you wouldn't have been there to hear the message. So I think there's a lot of forces that brought this about.
If you had to sort of pick one or two moments that you thought were so pivotal to the sort of success of what you've done, are there a couple of moments that stand out to you that you think were turning points?
Well, I look back on this and I kind of chuckle because I must have been a real bulldog. There were a number of diversity efforts in those times within Procter & Gamble. And, of course, even those days, they were talking about women, Hispanics, Asians, that sort of thing. No mention of gay and lesbian folks. And there would be special trainings for these people. And every year that would come down the pike. And I just kind of felt, you know, wait a second. You can invest this time and effort, and you can talk about diversity all you want. And yet, on one hand, here you are trying to market sort of off-label to this minority community, primarily gay men and those afflicted with HIV, but you can't bring that up. So I guess I saw a disease in these positions, and I recall going around and pounding on people's doors, which was unheard of at the time for a technician. I was not management. I only made it up one rung at Procter. I was the bottom of the heap. But, you know, I just got that old-time fervor, and I pounded on doors. And, you know, I was very much told, this isn't going to happen. We don't have to do it legally, which is still the case today, right? I mean, even the Obama administration has tried to interpret the laws, the 1964 Civil Rights Act, to kind of make sexual orientation and sexual identity and all these things kind of equivalent. But really, that's subject to interpretation. And of course, the current administration has taken a dimmer view of those sort of things. So there was a lot of stuff to overcome.
And what do you think brought about the film that was made about what happened?
That's kind of a mystery to me, because when I left P&G with an early retirement package in 2003, there's an affinity group there that formed shortly after the work in 93. And you know how politics are. People in social movements, crazy people do the work, and then once it's done and there's less risk, people that are a little more corporate, a little more conservative, kind of, they say that's a nice job, and they kind of push you out of the side. They wouldn't even acknowledge my peers and I as far as coming out in those days and saying, hey, you know, this group of people did this work. It was kind of, quote, quote, early gay activists is how it was phrased. Needless to say, that record's now all been set straight. So I guess I was also pushing up against that history. In other words, people were uncomfortable, but they got comfortable enough once the policy changed. And then, well, those people that did this work, maybe some of them aren't, you know, we're not really easily controlled. And we don't always say the right things. And we can be a pain in the backside. And so we're kind of pushed off to the side. And then what happens is the history is forgotten. I'll be the first person to admit I saved 30 years worth of documents, didn't share them with anybody. I knew it was corporate theft. I knew it was way beyond retention limits. I felt it was important, not because it was me, but because of the times and HIV and the work. That sort of thing didn't happen every day, and yet it happened. So I think a weird thing happened. 25 years go by. I had posted on good old Facebook about it early that year. I don't even think it was that. Someone within the company said, you know what? It's been a quarter of a century, and And the guy who produced this for P&G, Brent Miller, who is the executive producer, associate director of Beauty Care Communications, said, you know, I don't know. And they asked around about it. And as you can tell from the video, all of which is very accurate, finally somebody remembered the brand that was associated, and finally someone connected me to the brand. And then one day in May of 2017, I get this call. Oh, my.
How did you feel when you got the call?
Shall I tell you what I said?
Please.
To Mr. Miller. At first, I said something to the effect of, I had always wanted this story to be told, but I had to admit, I'm going to wrap myself out here, because he was asked recently in London about what I had said. And he reflected. I opened my mouth and I said, who the hell are you and why would you care? Because all this time had gone by. And, you know, I'm like a lot of activists. I have my own slings and arrows, my place of damage I was coming from, not just because of how people were treated at P&G that were different then, maybe a little bit of the fact that others at the time would not acknowledge the history. And even a local gay group had trouble acknowledging that history, crediting others. So when you see your history erased and you see the sacrifice erased, however well-intentioned, you know, you carry that with you and you just kind of put it off to the side. And another piece of it was, of course, the HIV pandemic that still rolls on. So there's just a lot of emotional stuff in that.
What do you think is the biggest challenge ahead for people fighting for LGBTQ equality?
First of all, we need to stop fighting ourselves. We spend entirely too much time picking at each other because we do represent a number of diversities. And not all the camps are always happy. After all, we represent the interest in some measure of transgendered people. We represent the interests of some bisexual folks. And, you know, each camp has their terminology and the words they want other people to use. And yes, we won't make mistakes as any group will make, but we should stop this single-minded focus at excising those who we disagree with. We need everyone in all these struggles, including people beyond our kind of umbrella or our rainbow protection. And I'm not always sure we do that very well.
Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, yeah. I can go on by the days.
We've been talking with Michael Chanik Jr., a Kent State alumnus and Cincinnati-based gay rights activist who worked to get Procter & Gamble to protect the rights of gay people against discrimination. Elevations is produced by Joe Gunderman, John Nungesser, and Ellie Ellis. I'm your host, Amy Reynolds, Dean of Kent State's College of Communication and Information. Join us every Saturday morning at 7 on 89.7 WKSU.